I'm interested, I guess, in general, in an event. And the event goes by many names and is described in different ways by different kinds of thinkers. In the work of Martin Heidegger, it is called the end of philosophy. Others use the name the end of history. In science, it is called cybernetics, or ecology, or systems theory, or topology. In economics, it is called post-Fordism. In industry, it is called computer networking. And in philosophy, we could say maybe that it just goes by the name of Gilles Deleuze. In general, I think we could call this event the emergence of the networked form of mediation. And I want to talk today not so much about networks as technologies, but as a kind of mode of mediation that I think can be understood in distinction to textuality as a mode of mediation and the image or visuality as a mode of mediation. I think that there's a purely machinic or systemic mode of mediation. So it's common to talk about networks in terms of equality, that networks bring a sense of even-handedness to affairs. It is common to say that networks consist of relationships between peers, for example, and that networks standardize and homogenize these relationships. So I begin like this not to suggest that these kinds of characterizations are entirely false, but rather to suggest that they obscure the reality of the situation. Networks only exist in situations of asymmetry or incongruity. If not, no network would be necessary. Symmetrical pairs can communicate, but asymmetrical pairs must network. So to begin to address the question, what can a network do, which is one of my kind of overarching questions, I want to look at what it means to be in a relationship of asymmetry, to be in a relationship of inequality, or a relationship of antagonism. And I think one of the more important places where asymmetry, antagonism, and inequality have been thought through is in, of course, the political and social arenas of political and social theory, and particularly in military theory. This is because military theory is one of the key places in which this notion of a kind of pure energy of antagonism has been explored, particularly around this question of the asymmetrical threat. And this kind of asymmetrical relationship comes by many names. Sometimes the asymmetrical threat is called the insurgent, the partisan, the irregular. Sometimes it's called a riot, a swarm, a crowd. Sometimes it's called a popular rebellion or a guerrilla force. I think these are some of the many synonyms for this what we might want to call this networked form of antagonism. And of course, it's why whenever you hear in the press, for example, talk about terrorism, you always hear of terrorist networks. Now, there are many thinkers, of course, who have explored this mode, including the classic theorists of sort of military theory, Sun Tzu, Clausewitz, and so on. Of course, the extension of these writings on guerrilla warfare in the work of Lenin or Mao Zedong. But I want to cite three passages from the very crucial late modern phase, which is crucial, I think, because of the special relationship that has arisen historically between the network mode of mediation and the middle to late 20th century and into the present day. And we won't have time to go into why there's a special relationship, but I do think there's a special relationship. So the first person I'll quote here is Robert Tabor, the author of one of the influential books on guerrilla insurgencies, War of the Flea. And he's writing here about the relationship between the guerrilla and state power. The guerrilla fights the war of the flea, and his military enemy suffers the dog's disadvantages. Too much to defend, too small, ubiquitous, and agile an enemy to come to grips with. If the war continues long enough, this is the theory, the dog succumbs to exhaustion and anemia without ever having found anything on which to close his jaws or to rake with his claws. So I'll quote a second author. This is Elias Canetti, the celebrated Bulgarian novelist who wrote on the, among other things, the animalistic qualities of the infuriated pack, the crowd. And I'm particularly interested in this classical referent, which are the Furies, the kind of the divine instantiation of the vengeful swarm. So this is Canetti writing on the infuriated pack. The first thing which strikes one about the pack is its unswerving direction. Equality is expressed in the fact that all are obsessed by the same goal, the sight of an animal, perhaps, which they want to kill. And this is one of the age-old paradoxes about a swarm, which is how does a centerless presence sort of achieve some sort of center or some sort of sovereignty, or can it? Maybe it cannot. And the third one I'll quote is from a French soldier and military theorist named Guy Brossolet, who I discovered through the work of Tikkun, and I was delighted by this discovery and thinking that this was a great example of network-centric warfare that predates all the stuff that happened in the late 90s and in the last decade. But then, of course, I discovered just a few days ago that, like many things, it was it's actually referenced in a footnote in Deleuze and Guattari's A Thousand Plateaus. So nothing can be discovered after that book. Okay. So this is Guy Brossolet, who wrote a fantastic and bizarre book in 1975 called Essay on Non-Battle. Non-Battle. And in this book, he described a system of non-battle which paradoxically was proposed within the Cold War logic, which is not an asymmetrical logic necessarily, even if there are these proxy wars and so on. But so within this kind of Cold War logic of deterrence, and here he talks about fighting forces that are made up of what he called pinpricks, not fists, deployed across a mesh of what he called presence modules, these kind of autonomous cells that can establish presence within military theaters. And these modules are supported by communication networks that can produce, quote, a series of minor but statistically consistent actions. And this is another moment where you see how probability and statistics enter back in within this network mode of mediation in a very low level. And certainly this is a theme also within this discourse on asymmetrical antagonism, that think about swarming, right? Every individual attack is relatively powerless, but as an overall effect, as a statistical effect, you can have a powerful cumulative effect. So he described this in terms of a multiform, maneuverable, and omnipresent presence. So again, a kind of notion of network-centric warfare from that predates the RAND research stuff that came out at the end of the 1990s. So these writings, along with many others, not only help explain what networks look like, rhizomatics, distributed networks, swarming clouds, impersonal agents, they also help support a much more important claim, which is not simply to describe this network mode of mediation, but the claim that at this moment in history, we are living through a kind of event, a kind of transformation. So in other words, and in much more concrete terms, I think we can expect a tendential fall in the efficiency of cultural objects, such as images and texts, and a marked increase in the efficiency of an entirely different format for aesthetic mediation: the system, the machine, the network. So what can a network do? There's a common way of answering this question, I think. Networks can bring down governments. Networks can build new empires out of the ashes of the old. Networks can use connectivity to propagate quickly into new spaces. Networks are the master of both the center and the perimeter, right? This power law notion, the notion of a long tail that can sort of counterbalance the spikes of high intensity. Networks are also often described as being, quote, out of control, that they tend to neuter the effects of traditional power centers. In short, that networks and hierarchies are always in opposition to one another, even as new networked sovereigns do appear on the scene. Okay, I don't want to necessarily answer the question in precisely that way. Instead, I'll answer the question of what can a network do using a concept from computer science, which is the concept of protocol. And in particular, the internet protocols, which are the standards that go into that are used to design and deploy network technologies and network communications. So I've spent some time analyzing these protocols, which are just written in normal prose and are available online. They're not particularly technical in the sense that they're not code or not just code. And I've tried to analyze these protocols from a technical perspective, but also from a kind of a perspective of organization, asking what are the values or the principles of organization that are embedded inside this technical system, this infrastructure. So I want to just summarize some of the results of this research. So what I'm about to describe, you might think of these as kind of virtues of the kinds of systems that are governed by protocol. So the first is that the internet protocols allow for interoperation between computers. Protocol's virtues include robustness, contingency, interoperability, flexibility, and heterogeneity. And I'll give one very, maybe perhaps a famous example, which is the so-called robustness principle, which comes from the protocol RFC 761, which is the protocol describing TCP, the Transmission Control Protocol, which is one of the core protocols. And the robustness principle goes like this: be conservative in what you do, be liberal in what you accept from others. And this is, I mean, you know, a fascinating sentence that, you know, at the very least it's fascinating because it's a kind of political philosophy, right? So for this to be embedded so deeply in the construction of technical infrastructure certainly struck me when I ran across it. So it is called the robustness principle Because if a technical system is, using their language, liberal in what it accepts and conservative in what it does, the technical system will be more robust over time. Of course, the obvious question, I think, is why is this called the robustness principle and not called, you know, something like the neoliberal principle or something like that? So maybe this indicates a second virtue of protocol, which is a desire for totality. As the robustness principle states, one must accept everything, no matter what source, sender, or destination. Because of this, I want to say that protocol, or a system that uses protocols, is a system of distributed management that facilitates peer-to-peer relationships between autonomous entities. And because of these virtues and these qualities, and owing to the global adoption of the protocols, I think this is true to say that the protocols are the first time we've actually had a global technical standard, a truly global singular technical standard. Because of this, I think we can say that the internet is the most highly organized mass media in history. And this should go against that conventional wisdom about how networks are out of control and their corrosive effects on power and so on. So finally, the last point, by way of summarizing what protocols are and how they work, then I think we can say that the internet protocols operate largely outside the two spheres that are most commonly identified when talking about power and control, which are, on the one hand, the state, which is to say the world of law, the juridical realm, and on the other hand, the commercial or corporate sector. There are other spheres, of course, but these are two important ones. And I'm also acknowledging, of course, that people from the commercial world are involved in drafting protocols and so on. But I do think that that it's important to acknowledge that there is a kind of material machinic infrastructure that I would say actually has agency or efficacy that is not reducible to these classical spheres of power, the state and the commercial sectors. And this is why I'm suggesting that we need to have an analysis, a kind of theory of organization and control that's appropriate for this space. Okay. So, I want to, in the time I have remaining, describe a few sort of details about this system that I think present important ramifications for the kinds of themes that we're discussing at this conference. So the first is that informatic networks are relatively indifferent to semantic content and interpretation. Semantic content and interpretation. And this is part of my desire to really separate theories of textuality from theories of systems and machines. So quite specifically, I would want to say that a network is not a text. And questions of interpretation, hermeneutic-type questions, semantic questions about meaning, these, I think, are so closely aligned with the tradition of textuality, textual analysis, that we need to maybe think outside that. So networks are not texts, and they have to be understood as systems. In other words, data is parsed. It is not read, at least in any conventional humanistic sense of reading. And I do mean read in a very kind of classical humanistic sense. And I'll give a quick example, which is the example of a checksum. And a checksum is just a simple kind of numeric signature that is used in a variety of contexts, but in particular, it's used in some of the core protocols to do error correction and things like that. So every packet that goes through a network has a checksum in it, or usually more than one. So a checksum is computed from scanning or parsing the content of a message. It is not realized via any kind of bona fide act of reading. It's a purely kind of technical transformation or transcoding of data. And I think that the model of the checksum is something that is much more appropriate for us than thinking about reading or something like that. So this tendency to be indifferent to interpretation and semantic content, I think, in a more general sense, could be called the anti-hermeneutic tendency of networks. And I sort of ended up trying to research the Furies by actually starting with the figure of Hermes, using Hermes as a kind of conceptual persona for thinking through the history of hermeneutics. There is another messenger god, which is the goddess Iris, who's the other kind of god of media, I might call her. The other one besides Hermes, she's never really talked about, but I've been doing some research into her mode of mediation, which is radically different from Hermes' mode. And then I'm suggesting here that the Furies are this the third option. Okay, so here I use the term hermeneutics to mean the textual science of interpretation, which has its roots in biblical interpretation, but of course which flourished right through the modern and the postmodern periods. In short, a new model of reading will have to be explored, one that is not hermeneutic in nature, but is instead based on this kind of infuriation, this cybernetic parsing, scanning, rearranging, filtering, and interpolating. And let me just note in passing that the advent of the so-called semantic web, I think, totally confirms and reinforces this tendency. I don't view that as a counterexample to this. And I think actually a lot of the papers so far in this conference have addressed this too. In short, I usually think when something is perfected in software, it's totally dead at that point. Right? So when you have this kind of model for semantic networking, that's sort of the end of interpretation, not an extension of it. And I hope this won't be interpreted as a kind of technophobic nostalgia on my part, but really an attempt to distinguish between, different modes of mediation. Okay, so the second of these three ramifications, before I finish, is what we might call the political tragedy of interactivity. Or, using our terminology today, the political tragedy of the transformation into a topological system. Now, what do we mean by a political tragedy? Well, interactivity and network bidirectionality, right? These have been very famously held up as a kind of progressive or utopian tendency within the media by authors such as Bertolt Brecht in his short Fragments on Radio, later also mentioned by Hans Magnus Enzensberger as part of his definition of what he called an emancipated media. Okay, so in the kind of classical, let's say, 1960s notion of media activism, one of the progressive goals is bidirectionality and interactivity. So how does a medium become emancipated? It shifts from being unidirectional to being bidirectional. Okay, so I think the situation has changed such that today bidirectionality is certainly the norm rather than the exception. And maybe further, that interactivity is one of the core instruments of organization today, and certainly one of the core instruments of control. So this is part of what I mean by this notion of the political tragedy of interactivity, that we got what we fought for, but what we fought for turned out to maybe not be what we thought it was going to be. Because today, networks ensnare us in the very act of connection. Networks are exceedingly efficient at articulating and conveying messages by bidirectionality. And in graph theory, this is what's called an undirected graph. In short, organisms must communicate today, whether they want to or not. And, you know, anybody familiar with cybernetics would not have been surprised by this event, right? You know, this is why in Norbert Wiener's famous original conception of cybernetics, it's communication and control together, right? These two things are inextricably linked. Organisms are captured, to use Phil Agri's terminology. It's also Deleuze and Guattari's terminology. They are captured using any number of informatic codes and rubrics. Clicks are accumulated. Behaviors are mined for meaningful data or tracked for illegal data. Even the genome is prospected for rare or otherwise useful sequences. And this is happening most notably in the so-called diversity hotspots, whether it's the Amazon or someplace else. So for example, pharmaceutical companies would go to these diversity hotspots and find pockets of biodiversity, which strictly as a kind of intensity have monetizable value in and of themselves. And these pockets of intensity are extracted and removed. So bioprospecting, which is what this is referred to, bioprospecting is itself a process of informatic interactivity, I think. The information in question is simply genetic in nature rather than in a relational database, for example, although it gets in a relational database very quickly. So that's what I mean by this idea of the political tragedy of interactivity. What was once so liberating for Enzensberger is today the very site of informatic exploitation, regulation, and control. So the third and last ramification that I'll describe is the tendency for software to privilege surface over source, while at the same time, in a kind of counterintuitive logic, championing sources as absolutely essential, even if they remain hidden. So we have, this is the bizarre part of computer discourse. You know, you have all this stuff about screens and interfaces, but then you have, everything is about sources, right? Open source and so on. So what does this mean? Well, software is often understood as existing at various levels or modes. So at the level of authorship, software exists as source code, which is a human-readable text that contains commands that are written in some kind of computer language like C++ or Java or something like that. When this source code is compiled, these commands are translated into machine-readable code called an executable application, consisting of basic commands that can be read by the machine. And then this creates a kind of third modality of software, the, quote, runtime experience, which is what we know as users of software. So these three modalities, the source, the executable, and the interface, are part of this kind of logic of surface and source. And it's quite confusing. The interface is often considered to be the most primary from some points of view, because it's the actually existing, almost a kind of phenomenological or anthropologically relevant experience of software. But at the same time, the executable is a kind of determining moment, because that's where, you know, the actual machinic processes are happening. But of course, that level is merely the result of a compilation of the source code, which is, you know, held up as this kind of perfect essence, this recipe that created the machine itself. A kind of musical score, if you will. So for the software source to work, it must appear in the form that it is not, in the form of the executable, only to be experienced in a third form, entirely different from the first two. So this is a very bizarre logic. It's actually even, if you think about it, more complicated than the logic, let's say, of the commodity fetish or something, which is structured the way critique, you know, critical work in the 20th century, for example, is, you know, largely driven by the structure of the commodity. And so with my colleague Eugene Thacker, we like to call this the occult logic of software, the occult logic, which is to say that software hides itself at exactly the moment when it expresses itself most fully. And some of my stuff I'm working on now has to do with this idea of the black box, and how we're, if the commodity fetish is sort of the original black box, the rational kernel and the mystical shell, we're definitely in an age now where we have a new black box, which is not the fetish black box, but the function black box. So we have the rational shell and the mystical kernel. So I'll just end with a kind of hopefully amusing reference to something that I read about in the news recently, which is that, and I use this as a way to hopefully describe the conundrum that we're in right now, which is that apparently scientists have discovered a vaccine for cocaine, the cocaine vaccine, which surprised me. So the cocaine vaccine works in a way very similar to other vaccines, vaccines for diseases and so on. So a serum is administered to a patient, and then the effects of the drug are neutralized. Just as how the effects of flu, for example, would be neutralized with a flu vaccine. But, and this is the crucial point, the cocaine vaccine does not remove the cravings of addiction, which is to say, the desire to acquire and use the drug. And so in this topological age, in this age of the kind of the kind of neoliberal network where we have the liberation of the individual, the liberation of affect, the sort of Deleuzian utopia which came true, right? I think that the cocaine vaccine is a perfect image for us in this situation, which is to say that we still have the cravings, but we can't get high. We have a liberation of individual desire and freedom, a liberation of openness. Never before has desire and affective expression been so liberated, right? May 68 worked, and now we're living with the consequences. We have so many cravings for desire, for democracy, for food, for drink, for oil, for connectivity. But at the same time, we are unable to realize the utopian pleasures of these promises. Our networks are also our weapons. Our webs are also our own snares. Interactivity is drudgery. Transparency comes at the cost of black boxing everything. And I think this is essentially the condition of the digital citizen today, the citizen living within these topological spaces. Thank you very much.